Before the settlers arrived, tall grass prairie covered the state of Iowa. Of the 300 million acres that once blanketed the land, less than one-tenth of 1% remains. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we'll talk about efforts to recreate that lost landscape. Daryl Smith is the director of the Tallgrass Prairie Center at the University of Northern Iowa. We'll talk about prairie restoration efforts, seed collection, and why it's important to preserve this part of our natural heritage. At the Neil Smith National Wildlife Refuge near Newton, you can lose yourself in 5,000 acres of tallgrass prairie. The wildlife refuge is also home to many of the animals that were native to the Iowa prairie, including a herd of buffalo. We'll talk about the role buffalo play in the prairie ecosystem and efforts to reintroduce them. Join the conversation after this news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about tall grass prairies, Iowa's native landscape. And later this hour, we're going to talk about one of the most charismatic animals that dominated that landscape, the buffalo. We'll explore the role that buffalo played in the prairie ecosystem. And we'll also talk about efforts to reintroduce them in some places, including the Neil Smith National Wildlife Refuge near Newton. But first, let's start with the land. Daryl Smith is the director of the Tallgrass Prairie Center at the University of Northern Iowa, and the land is his specialty. Hello, Daryl.
Good morning.
How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you.
Great. Thank you so much for being here. In my billboard today, I mentioned that pre-settlement, there were 300 million acres of tallgrass prairie in the state of Iowa. What did the state look like when the first Europeans arrived here?
Correction there before we start. There were about 300 million acres all overall, about 30 million in Iowa.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry, that's a ridiculous mistake to make. But let me ask the question again then. What did the state look like when the Europeans arrived?
Well, much of it was tallgrass prairie. The northern part of the state was almost entirely dominated by tallgrass. And then in the southern part of the state, which was glaciated longer ago, there had been a longer time for the landscape to develop, so there are some hills and valleys. So the prairie was interspersed with bur oak and other savanna-type species. But basically, approximately 80% of the state was prairie at the time of settlement. So it was a large component, and savanna composed about 6 or 7% of that too.
How many acres do you estimate of prairie there are in the state today?
Well, that's a little bit difficult to nail down completely, but when you start talking about good quality prairie, you're talking about less than one-tenth of 1%. So it's been pretty much converted. And the black soil prairie, which was the largest component of prairie and the part that occupied most of the northern part of the state, has been almost all converted to cropland. And the prairies that remain are prairies that remain on sandy soil or rocky soil or out-of-the-way places that are not really accessible to agriculture.
Places that were just forgotten about.
Yes.
At what point did someone start to think, uh-oh, we've destroyed this landscape. We need to do something to protect it?
Well, that's an interesting question because when the settlers first encountered it in the 1830s and 40s, they thought it was so vast that it would never be converted, but they settled it, and most of the settlement had completed, and more than 90% had been converted in the first 70 years of settlement. And so it wasn't approximately until the turn of the 20th century that Thomas McBride, who later became president of the University of Iowa, noted that much of the prairie had been plowed, almost all the prairie had been plowed. So he began to worry about it a little bit at the turn of the century. And then his colleague, Bohemil Shimek at the University of Iowa, wrote an extensive article on prairies in 1911 in which he commented on how rapidly it was being converted to cropland. But they were the early warning signs, and no one else was really particularly concerned.
When did the more modern effort to actually maintain what was left of the virgin prairie and then start reconstructing new prairie begin?
Well, there were a couple of efforts. In the 1930s, Shimek was the head of a committee that was attempting with other states in the Midwest and Canada to set aside prairie in each of their states as representative and of the original prairie. And they were working on a 5,000-acre area up on the Little Sioux Valley just west of Lake Okoboji. But that Shimmick died during that period, and there was no one left to carry on. So that was sort of an abortive effort, didn't bear too much fruit. Probably the most extensive effort was undertaken in the 40s, 1940s, with Ada Hayden, who was the professor at Iowa State University at that time, and another ecologist at Iowa State, John Eichmann, and they teamed with the Conservation Commission and tried to work with through the Iowa Academy of Science and evaluated a number of sites across the state and presented them as potential candidates. So that was probably the first real effort that that bore some fruit later on.
What were the reasons given at that time in the 40s for making an effort to conserve this landscape?
Well, it was pretty much the same as the ones that we have now. It's something that was being lost. It was important to maintain this as a representative landscape. There's some things that we need to know about this landscape if we want to attempt to recover it. So they were making some of the same arguments to preserve these for future generations and for educational purposes too.
When did you get involved in prairie reconstruction?
I was one of those people who was sort of turned on to prairie reconstruction in the early 70s. I had become interested in prairies in the 60s, but the idea of prairie reconstruction sort of came about with the first Earth Day. I had a chance to visit with Paul Shepard, who was reconstructing a prairie at Knox College in Galesburg, Illinois at that time, and he sort of got me interested. And so as a result of that, I planted the first prairie on the UNI campus in the spring of 1973.
When you planted that first prairie, where did the seeds come from?
Well, that's an interesting question. At that time, there wasn't very much seed available. If you're going to plant a prairie, you could collect it yourself. And naturally, at that time, I was in a hurry to get things done, so that was going to take several years. So I thought, well, we need to get seed someplace else. And you could get some from local people who were collecting seed by hand, but it was very expensive. So the only other seed available were native grass seed that was being produced in large quantities in like Nebraska and Kansas, cultivated varieties for rangeland restoration. So that's where we got our first seed. Wouldn't do that now, but at that time, that was about the only seed that was available on short notice.
Darryl, what was it that really hooked you? And you've devoted your entire career to this. What was that moment that made you think, this is what I want to be a part of?
Well, I think it started when I was a graduate student in South Dakota. My professor took me to visit a couple of prairie remnants. I was in my mid-20s at that time. I grew up in Iowa, but I'd never knowingly seen a prairie remnant. And knowing the part of the state that I'm from, there probably wasn't one there in extreme southeast Iowa. And so it really appealed to me. I think I'm sort of a historian at heart, too, and so I think the idea of a past ecosystem that was under duress had some sort of appeal to me. I always joke that when I watch sporting events, if I don't have a particular team that I'm rooting for, I root for the underdog, and so I sort of viewed prairie as an underdog and so felt that it needed some support and help and encouragement. And I think that's what hooked me initially. And probably as a result of that, I sort of romanticized in my mind what the original prairie landscape looked like. Not sure it was valid, but at least it was one that I conjured up in my mind anyway, and it seemed awfully neat. And I thought that would be nice to replicate that if we could.
When you first got those first seeds, how did you go about trying to make sure that you had the proper mix of species, of grasses?
Well, things were really early. That was early on in the restoration period, although there had been some restoration done at the University of Wisconsin much earlier. The general public and the overall were just getting into it in the late 60s and early 70s. And so there wasn't as much care on mixing the seed precisely as we do now. And so you estimated upon other people's anecdotal experiences and recommendations. And now we look back at those recommendations, and the amount of grass seed that was recommended for planting at that time was extremely high. We wouldn't plant that much grass in a prairie reconstruction now on a bet.
How do you know now what the diversity of the species was like?
Well, we've learned from experience. I like to say that I've done some things wrong, and I guess we all do things wrong when we're learning. The the true learning is not to do them wrong the second time. And we've learned that if you plant too much grass, it's very, very difficult to get the forbs or wildflowers, as we call the forbs, established. So if you have too much grass, it's just going to be grass, and you don't have a real mixture of prairie species.
Have you been able to study some of the virgin plots of prairie to be able to look at the mix of species there, or is that even representative because these were the prairie that remained?
Yes, that's a good question, and there's a lot of debate about that particular one. Yes, we do study the prairie remnants that remain. That's about our only source of information. There are not very many records of what the original prairie was like from botanists back in that time. Illinois is a little bit luckier. They've got a Dr. Mead, who was a dentist who traveled in one of the western counties in Illinois, who recorded some of the species. But we don't have anybody that did that in Iowa, so we really don't know what the species were like. So the remnants are about all that we have, and we do study those extensively. But as you point out, and as I mentioned earlier, those prairies that remain are not representative of the ones that were here because it was mostly black soil prairie in Iowa, and there's very little of that remaining. And the other ones were sand prairies and rocky outcrop prairies, and the species distribution is going to be different in those. And then even in the black soil prairies that survived, and there were a few of them, they survived mostly because they were used for hay fields. And if you hay each... And they usually hay about the same time each year. So if you do that, you're bound to eliminate some of the species that are in their prime right at the time when you hay them. So that may have changed the distribution too. So there's a lot of guesswork involved in that. And we try to do the best we can and use as much information as we have available, but we're missing some.
When I was a child, I remember getting involved in seed collection efforts. Someone would spot a stand of big blue stem in a ditch somewhere, and then people would go out and collect those seeds. So do these native grasses still just pop up around the state in some areas?
There are places you can still find relic establishments of them along roadsides, and as I said, in some of the out-of-the-way places that were unreachable by agriculture, you do find relic species left, and those make excellent seed sources. In fact, we have a program at the Tallgrass Prairie Center that we call Natural Selections, in which we go to remnant sites and collect a very small quantity of seed and then bring it back to the center and increase it and make it available to native seed growers.
Well, we'll talk more about restoration efforts in a moment. I'm talking with Daryl Smith of the Tallgrass Prairie Center at the University of Northern Iowa. You're listening to Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we're talking about Tallgrass Prairie, Iowa's native landscape. And my guest right now is Daryl Smith. He's the director of the Tallgrass Prairie Center at the University of Northern Iowa. And you're welcome to join the conversation with your questions. Maybe you've been involved in prairie restoration. Maybe you're hoping to be involved in prairie restoration. You have some questions for Daryl. Or maybe you'd like to talk about the moment when you first encountered Tallgrass Prairie and what that felt like. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send us email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And in a few minutes, we're also going to talk about one of the creatures that roamed the plains. We're going to talk about the buffalo and the role that they played in the prairie ecosystem. Daryl, before the break, we were talking about prairie restoration efforts. When you actually decide that you're going to plant a prairie, you have the land. I know that the topsoil makeup in the state has changed dramatically since the days of the Tallgrass Prairie. Is the land still a good place for prairie?
Yes. In fact, I think the prairie can help the land recover. One of the things that we have found that the prairie does very well in poor soil, and in fact sometimes does better because weeds like rich soil, and so the weed competition is less in poor soil. So, yeah, the soil is fine. In fact, I think we can help improve the soil if we plant prairies and give them the chance for the root systems to develop.
What do you do when you have the land? How do you prepare it?
Well, when I first started, typical recommendation was to fall plow and to give a chance for the roots of the weeds to overwinter and be perhaps killed or the soil to soften. And then you would disc and harrow several times in the spring to make sure that you got a good kill of the existing weeds before you plant it. More recently, the glyphosate Roundup has been used to replace the plowing so that you don't have to disturb the soil, and so you can spray the area with Roundup prior to planting. And that way you don't have to disturb the top few inches, which contain a lot of the weed seeds. And so you can help get a little bit more of an edge on the weeds in that manner. And so you can spray it with Roundup, wait 3 or 4 days, and then seed directly into the site.
I'm sure we have some ecology-minded people who are listening and saying, you spray Roundup all over a field before you plant prairie?
Yes, we do. And there's some debate about how residual Roundup is, but it has limited residual effect. And so we have not encountered a problem with doing that.
Okay, so once you have the land cleared, or at least you hope cleared of weeds, what happens next?
Then you seed, and you have your choice. You can use a native grass drill and put the seed directly into the soil a certain depth, or you can what they call broadcast seed and seed it right on the surface of the soil and then put a drag or harrow across the top of it to sort of increase the seed-to-soil contact and plant it in that particular way. But as you alluded to earlier, it's very important that you design the seed mixture that you want before you seed it. And we usually plant somewhere between 40 and 50 seeds per square foot, a mixture of grasses and forbs before we plant. And so we're very careful depending upon the type of prairie that we're interested in planting for that mixture of forbs and grasses.
How long does it take to get a prairie established?
If you're very successful in controlling weeds, you can get some pretty good establishment the first year. And that's one of the benefits with the newer techniques. With better weed control, the prairie establishes more quickly. When I first started, they used to say, well, you really have to wait about 3 or 4 years for the prairie to become well established. I think now you can say it can be well established in a couple of years usually.
And do you have to burn it for it to become a healthy prairie?
It benefits from burning. Usually when you first start, there's not enough fuel to carry a fire, so sometimes you have to wait a year or so until you have a sufficient fuel to carry the fire, but that will also help reduce the weed competition and stimulate the growth of the prairie plant. So it's very beneficial.
I know a lot of people have planted small prairies in urban areas. Can you achieve the same effects through mowing that you can through a burn?
Almost. I think there's a certain, with the return of the ash and stuff to the soil, the fire probably has a slight edge. But if you can't burn, you can mow and remove the vegetation. Don't leave the vegetation there, but mow and remove the vegetation, and that'll do almost as well as burning.
All right. We have Rob on the line from Cedar Rapids. Hello, Rob.
Yes, hi. Wonderful conversation. Thank you. I'm involved, there's been a prairie replanted in Cedar Rapids here, and I was curious. This is the second year. They took it down with the Roundup. A couple things. I've noticed that it seems to have massive stands of thistle throughout it, and really tall stuff, and I was kind of surprised because some of the prairie stuff I've seen didn't seem to be dominated. And also, it looks like the crown vetch, that low, thick, matty stuff came back with a vengeance on this project, and I was wondering, is that typical for like a second year? I mean, this would be would have been planted, a year ago this spring. And is that typical?
Well, I would ask a couple of questions. First of all, did they do establishment mowing the first year after they planted it? Because we usually mow it several times the first year and keep the vegetation down about 2 or 3, at most 4 inches tall the first year to help control weeds.
So it needs to be cut right away.
Yeah, right away the first year. And then usually it's not necessary to mow the second year. The tall thistles don't concern me particularly because there are several native thistles that get quite tall, and they don't compete very well with the other native species. But the crown vetch concerns me a lot. And if you've got crown vetch, and you need to verify that, but if you've got crown vetch, you may need to start over because crown vetch has a tremendous amount of seed that gets in the seed bank, and it takes several years of site preparation before you can feel safe. And the crown vetch, you can't get rid of the crown vetch because everything you do to it harms the prairie, or everything you do to help the prairie helps the crown vetch.
One other question. I've noticed that there's finally garlic mustard out in this open, sunny stuff, too, which really surprised me. And is that a change that's coming about in the garlic mustard, that it's getting more sun-adaptive, or is that a threat?
I don't know that that's a particular threat in the sunny areas. In the semi-shaded areas, garlic mustard is a real threat. I'd have to assess that a little bit more. But I suspect if you're able to control the garlic mustard through mowing and cutting, that the prairie vegetation will eventually crowd out the garlic mustard. But the crown vetch would be my biggest worry.
All right, Rob, good luck, and it sounds like a lot of work to do there. Beverly's on the line now from Des Moines. Hello, Beverly.
Hello. Thank you very much. Great program. Professor Smith, a question for you. A group that I know about, inner city preschool in Des Moines, is going to be developing a series of urban prairies. What is the benefit of that in, you know, a high density, really urban neighborhood for urban prairies? And have you heard of the success or failure of those?
Well, I encourage them greatly. The main thing that you have to be concerned about in urban prairies is make sure that you've got open sunlight to the site. The prairies do much better in high sunlight, and so if you're in a shady area, they won't do quite so well. You may want to consider some savanna vegetation or something of that nature. But I think prairies in the urban areas are great, because I think every Iowan should have some experience of the prairie, which was a part of our biological and cultural heritage. And even if it's a small patch, I think they can begin to experience it. And that's one of the things that motivates me to restore and reconstruct prairies, because I think we need examples for people to visit and see and experience.
Is there a plot of land that you would consider to be too small to plant a prairie?
No.
All right. That's a good definitive answer to that question.
I think a square foot, if you can get some plants in there, someone will learn from those.
All right. Beverly, thank you so much for your call. I know that your center has done a lot of work with the roadside vegetation program, with planting prairies along Iowa roadsides. What do you think is the benefit of that?
Yes, Kirk Henderson manages that part of our program, and that I think it's Iowa is far ahead of the rest of the states in the United States in roadside vegetation management, and its basic reason is to help get an edge on weed control, because the natives can outcompete the weeds, but also you provide a very beautiful alternative for people driving down what can be a very monotonous roadside if you have some prairie flowers blooming alongside and some of the grasses coming on. And so I think not only beauty, but in controlling weeds and just maintaining some of the original vegetation here. And we're kind of lucky in Iowa from that standpoint that prairie was the original vegetation, because prairie does very well in roadsides.
The number to call if you'd like to join our conversation is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We're talking tallgrass prairies today with Daryl Smith from the Tallgrass Prairie Center at the University of Northern Iowa.
Oh, give me a home where the buffalo roam, where the deer and the antelope play.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and we're talking about tall grass prairies today. My guest is Daryl Smith. He's the director of the Tall Grass Prairie Center at the University of Northern Iowa. And we're going to talk a little bit now about one of the creatures that once roamed those prairies. We're going to talk about the buffalo and their role in the prairie ecosystem. Joining me are Christy Smith. She is the Wildlife Refuge Manager at the Neil Smith National Wildlife Refuge. And Karen Vista Sparkman, also a biologist at the Neil Smith Wildlife Refuge, which is near Prairie City in central Iowa. Hello, Christy and Karen.
Good morning.
Hi, thank you so much for being here today.
Well, we thank you very much for inviting us, and we're looking forward to the conversation.
Well, Christy, I want to ask you a question first. You have a group of buffalo living on the National Wildlife Refuge. How large is your herd?
Currently, our herd is about 100 head. We'd like to maintain it at about 70.
I want to get my terminology correct right off the bat. I'm using the term buffalo right now because when I was looking at the information about the wildlife refuge, you used the word buffalo. We also use the word bison quite a lot. How should I talk about them?
Well, for the most part, they are bison, and that indicates that they are the North American herd. Buffalo is a generic term for this type of animal, so it's acceptable as well. But if you're speaking on a scientific level, the correct name is bison.
Okay. And I want to go back with Daryl. A few minutes ago, we talked about what the landscape looked like in Iowa as the settlers came here. Let's talk about the bison. How many bison were on the land in Iowa when the settlers came here?
Well, that's a good question. The bison were probably less abundant in Iowa than they were further west, but there definitely were bison in Iowa, as there were also considerable numbers of elk.
All right. And Christy, I was looking at your website today, and you had a quote from Lewis and Clark talking about the bison.
Oh, yes. There were several reports about bison throughout the area, but as Dr. Smith said, we doubt that as many were here as there may have been further west, but they were here.
All right. Why did you decide that you wanted to have a herd at the National Wildlife Refuge?
Well, we felt that it was an important part of the prairie ecosystem. We've also introduced native insects such as butterflies to the ecosystem here. Karen probably has a little more information on that. I don't know. I have just arrived on this refuge the end of June, and I'm learning a lot about the mission of Neil Smith. But I do know that bison were an integral part of the ecosystem and how the prairie thrived.
All right, and we were having a little trouble with Karen's phone line, but Karen Vista Sparkman is here now. Karen, I was just asking about the decision to have a herd of buffalo within the wildlife refuge. Did you want to add something there?
Well, part of what we're trying to do is restore everything that belongs in the prairie, the ecosystem, and the bison were an integral part, as Christy said, of the grazing process actually helps the prairie plants, stimulates growth of the plants, and as the bison moved across the landscape, they would alter that and create different habitat for various wildlife out there. So bison are a major part of the whole prairie ecosystem.
And of course, although bison were not as common in Iowa, they were extremely common across the plains. But at one point, the number of bison in the United States got down to about 300, right?
Yeah, that's right.
How did this animal come back from, it was on the brink of extinction. How did it come back?
Well, it's a pretty amazing story. It was actually, there were a few populations still wild out in Yellowstone and some of the western areas, and also cattle ranchers kept bison, and there were a few ranchers that tried breeding bison, and they tried breeding them with the cattle, too. And so now a lot of bison out there have cattle genes in them. They've been hybridized, but the bison were actually saved, the species was basically saved by ranchers, and then some of those contributed to the herds that are now set aside for conservation.
Right, they tried to hybridize them to create the beefalo.
Yeah, the idea was that the bison were hardier than the cattle, and so by crossing them, you'd get a hardier animal that could survive under harsher weather conditions and still produce good meat.
And they found that wasn't true, and that's probably what we have to thank for the existence of the bison today.
Right. Yeah. They weren't too successful in the hybridization. It was a lot of effort. They don't hybridize very naturally. So.
Did you have any trouble introducing bison on the wildlife refuge?
No. When they were originally introduced, I wasn't here then, but it was not a big thing. Just released the bison. We had to build a fence around them. Of course, they can't have them wandering around in people's farm fields. But so we had to build a really sturdy fence, and We haven't had any problems with them.
What's their temperament like?
Well, they're wild animals. They do appear calm. They'll walk around. We have a road that goes right through the bison enclosure, so people can drive their cars through, and they'll just stand there on the road. And people mistake that for being a tame animal. But if they are provoked, they will. They can be pretty violent. They fight. The males will fight with each other during the breeding season. And when we do a roundup, they're trapped, and we try to force them to go through chutes. They'll fight back.
What kind of changes have you seen in the prairie landscape that the bison are a part of? Obviously, they don't have free range over the entire National Wildlife Refuge, but in their area, have you seen an impact?
Yeah, it's definitely different than everything outside of the bison enclosure, because the grazing really affects the vegetation. The biggest differences that are apparent is, you know, there's shorter grasses, and so there are different wildlife species that are there. Grasshopper sparrows is one species of bird that we see mostly in that grazed area because they prefer shorter vegetation. Another thing that the bison influences, they wallow, so they'll create these bare patches in the vegetation, and that actually stimulates the growth of, you know, more annual plants that need that disturbance, and so the actual vegetation is different, and those wallows will collect water. And, you know, there are, this year with all our rain, there were aquatic invertebrates living in some of those wallows.
How do you manage the herd?
Well, we do minimal, as little as possible. We do monitor them and keep an eye on their health. And if there are animals that look like they're not doing well, we keep an eye on them. For the most part, we don't do a whole lot in terms of medication or anything like that. We do have a roundup every year, and we handle the animals. We run them through a chute. We take their weight and look at their general condition, and then one of the biggest things we're doing for management is looking at their genetics. So we have to take genetic samples from all the calves that are born and then give them a microchip. So each individual is recognizable through a scanner to detect its microchip.
Is that in an effort to make sure that you're actually breeding bison as opposed to breeding bison that still have those cattle genetics?
Well, that one of the things we look at is the cattle genetics, and there are certain markers for cattle genes, but we don't know for sure that any bison doesn't have cattle genes at some point in its history. But we are looking at the genetic diversity. So there are certain genes that are rare within the whole population of bison, you know, all across the continent. And so we want to make sure we preserve those genes. We don't know what they do, and we don't know if they're beneficial or not, but we just feel like we need to make sure that they survive to keep any genes from going extinct to help the survival of the species.
We're talking about tall grass prairies today and some of the animals who live on them on Talk of Iowa. And with me, I have Karen Vista-Sparkman, a biologist at the Neil Smith National Wildlife Refuge. Also, Christy Smith, the manager of the Neil Smith Wildlife Refuge. And Daryl Smith, who is the director of the Tall Grass Prairie Center at the University of Northern Iowa. You can join the conversation with prairie questions or bison questions as well. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Daryl, I know a lot of people still have questions for you. Peter is on the line in Iowa City. Hello, Peter.
Hi, hello.
Hi there. What was your question?
Okay. Is there any kind of an estimate of what the soil loss rate through the river, carried off by the rivers, was in when prairie days versus nowadays?
I'm sure there's some sort of an estimate. I don't know exactly what it is, but it was very limited. Erosion was much more minimal because of the prairie landscape, and the only time that you had a tear in the fabric of that was if it was heavily disturbed. Perhaps when a herd of bison would go through, you would get some erosion, but it would be very limited.
Well, the root system of the prairie was extremely extensive. I mean, we read these histories of sod houses, so I can't imagine that much erosion could have occurred.
Not much, no.
All right. Peter, thank you so much for your question. James is on the line in Adel. Hello, James.
Hello.
Hi.
Well, I've been had to wait a long time to answer that. That's a pretty simple question, but I like to check out natural prairie areas around my area. There's Boas Conservation Area and Coin Conservation Area here in Dallas County, and I was recently over and checked out Cedar Prairie over in Guthrie County, and my question is, Cedar, for example, is a pretty small area, and it's beautiful, and I was wondering to what extent was what I was seeing what the pioneers would have seen, or to what extent, I mean, that's surrounded all the way around by cultivated areas and so on, and to what extent would seed from the surrounding areas get in there and really change the plant mix?
That's a very good question, because these remnants are isolated. They're islands in an agricultural sea, and so they're under constant stress from chemicals, siltation from adjoining fields, invasive species. So that's a very good question as to how that compared with the original vegetation. The one thing that we have going for us is that prairie vegetation, we think, is a very long-lived. So we may be still looking at some of the plants that were there before it was plowed around them. But those isolated remnants are under stress. The genetics is probably diminishing because the diversity is being lost. So we don't know that they're exactly the same. In fact, they probably aren't exactly the same. And how similar they are, we're working on that, but we don't have a good definitive answer for that.
James, thank you for your patience, and thank you for your question. Daryl, are there species that you're searching for that maybe you've read about from, I know that there weren't botanists in particular studying the tallgrass prairie, but are there some lost species that you're hoping to find?
Well, certain sites often have species that what we call have been extirpated or removed and lost from the site, and we're trying to find those, but usually we can find someplace in the state where a species still remains, but those numbers are diminishing.
Bill is on the line from Sac City. Hello, Bill.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call. Dr. Smith, I would appreciate it if you would describe the Iowa Local Ecotype Seed Project that Greg Housel heads at the Tallgrass Prairie Center at UNI, and secondly, why that project is important to the state of Iowa as a whole. And lastly, when somebody tries to restore a prairie, what should they look for in a seed source, and what should they avoid?
Okay, there are several questions there. I'll do the best I can with my memory. Basically, the Natural Selections Project that Greg Housel manages at the center is what we used to call the Ecotype Project. And what we're doing is that we collect seed in different areas across the state and bring back small quantities and increase those seeds and make them available to native seed growers. And since we know where we collected these seeds, we're able to document the source of the seeds. And there's a new program that started in the mid-90s called Source Identified Seed, so that you know the origin of the seed that you're using. And I think that's very important when you're planting a prairie. And we don't want to bring seeds in from other states or cultivated varieties that when developed. We want to keep as close as we can to the natural selections that were here. There is some debate going on about what they call local ecotypes versus more broad ecotypes. Some people feel that you shouldn't plant seed that's located any further than maybe 10 or 15 miles from the source of your from where you're planting your prairie. And there's some debate about that, but very definitely you should pay attention to the origin of your seed and the source where you collected that seed.
Is there a good rule of thumb as far as looking for seed when you start a project?
Well, one of the rules of thumb is that I think you want to look on a site that's as similar to the site that you're working on. For example, if you're working on a soil that's rocky, then look for seed on rocky outcrops and things like that. If you're working on a sandy site, a source seed from a sandy location. I think the soil types and the place where the seed is collected is more important than the distance.
I want to talk a little bit about educating particularly young people about the prairie, but educating everyone about the prairie. And Christy, I want to turn to you first because I know you do a lot of educational programs at the Neil Smith Wildlife Refuge. What do you try to help people experience when they come and visit the prairie?
We try to have them experience a little bit of the history. The visitor center is set up in sort of a three-phase period. We have folks come in and look at a 15-minute movie presentation that explains what the prairie used to be and the history of what happened to the prairie with the Native Americans and with farming and the advent of the land grabs that went on. But once they go through that, it kind of opens their mind up a little bit to think about what it used to be like. And so when they go out through the center, they see some of the history, not only wildlife, but the people history of the area. And we've interviewed a lot of folks that were kind of old-timers or had historical knowledge, and we have presentations of that throughout the center. But then lastly, we invite them to get out into the prairie. Once we've given them a little bit of a mental stimulation and information, we want them to get out and just experience not only what it looks like, but how it smells and how it sounds. We have a lot of programs that look at insects, not just the bison. The bison are a beautiful thing to see out here, but we want them to understand that most of the life here was insect or underground, and there's a lot of beauty just by looking around them, not having to go very far.
5,000 acres is a lot of prairie. Is there a place where you can stand at the wildlife refuge where you can't see anything else?
Well, unfortunately, where you can't see anything else. When I'm finished, you might ask Karen that, but we are looking. Currently, we're undergoing what's called a comprehensive conservation plan, and that's sort of one of our goals. We're trying to find ways to get people to the prairie and to view the prairie instead of just from our visitor center, from a parking lot or from a roadway, to get them out onto the prairie so that they can experience and be immersed in it somewhat. And not only during the growing season, but maybe during the winter season as well. The prairie has a lot of beauty and a lot of biological importance that takes place when the grasses and the plants are dormant as well. So we're working on that.
How about you, Karen? Obviously, you've spent a lot of time in the prairie at the Wildlife Refuge. Have you been able to find a place where you can feel like you're in undisturbed prairie?
Well, this time of year when the grasses are tall, all you have to do is walk out in there and you can't see anything else. The grasses are over your head. But we do have roads and power lines that go through the refuge that kind of interrupt the big view. But if you go to the right spot, you can be surrounded by prairie.
In many wildlife or nature areas, you're encouraged not to get off the trail. Do you encourage people who visit the wildlife refuge to step into that grass and experience that?
Yes. there are limited areas that you can go, to go off the trail. We don't want people wandering around too far because of safety issues. If we're running equipment out there, we don't want to run people over because, like I said, the grass is over your head. But around the visitor center and some of the other areas close to the building, you're able to get off the trail.
Daryl, I know that, of course, the Wildlife Refuge is one of the places in Iowa where the prairie is extensive enough that you can get that feeling. But even if you're visiting a small plot of prairie, what do you think people should look for and try to experience?
Well, I think look at the plants, examine the plants, think about the plants. And when I'm on a prairie, I find my mind drifting back into the past. So I sort of conjure up images that may not be there at the moment but may have been there in the past. So I encourage people to visit prairies, look at the plants, feel the plants, look at the animals that are there, and think about what it was like in the past.
Why do you think it's so important for people to have that experience?
Well, as I said earlier, I think it's a part of our biological and cultural heritage, and I think that if we don't maintain that contact, that we suffer from that. And I think as a society we suffer, and I think that we need to be aware of that prairie and supportive of maintaining it.
Amen.
Prairie restoration has come a long way since the early 1970s when you got involved in it, Daryl. But what needs do you still see that what is lacking in the movement?
Well, enthusiasm isn't lacking. We've got a lot of people involved and interested in prairies all over Iowa and the Midwest and beyond. We just held a conference a week and a half ago in which we had 560 people from 23 states, 3 provinces, and 2 foreign countries in addition to Canada. So there's a lot of interest in it. I think we need to keep striving to try to determine what some of the original composition was. We need to strive harder to increase our amounts of native seeds that are available and increase our diversity. But those are, in a sense, those are kind of fine-tuning.
Well, Daryl Smith, thank you so much for your time today. Daryl Smith is the director of the Tallgrass Prairie Center at the University of Northern Iowa. Thanks a lot. Also, Christy Smith and Karen Vista Sparkman were both here today from the Neil Smith National Wildlife Refuge near Prairie City, Iowa. Thank you to you both.
Thank you.
Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Technical support today came from Tony Daner in Cedar Falls. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org at all times. And you can send us email anytime. talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org is our address. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, we will visit the Iowa State Fair with Catherine Perkins and John Temple. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Oh,